Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the first lecture in the Gilda Lehmann lecture series in American history here at the LSE. It's a very great pleasure for me on behalf of the Cold War Studies Center and the Department of International History to greet, I think, one of the leading American historians today, who will be doing a lecture later on, Professor Gordon Wood from Brown University. But before turning over to Professor Wood, I want to introduce some of the other people who are here very briefly. This lecture series would never have come about if it hadn't been for the decision by the Gilda Lehmann Institute to provide the logistics and the funding to get it underway. And it's really quite a remarkable thing to do, because there are very, very few institutions these days who invest in history, at least history prior to the 20th century, with the kind of enthusiasm and the kind of ability that the Gilda Lehmann Institute has done. And it's a great pleasure for me to have here with us tonight one of the founders of the Gilda Lehmann Institute, Mr. Richard Gilder, and I'll turn over to him in a second. We also have the president of the Institute, James Basker, who teaches at Columbia University, who is with us here today. The Gilda Lehmann Institute was founded in 1994, and according to its charter, it promotes the study and the love of American history. And I think that's rightly put in terms of what the Institute has been able to achieve. It is an institution that's increasingly international in scope, as well as covering the United States. And its target audiences ranges from students to scholars and very much to the general public, because many of the activities undertaken by the Institute are aimed as much at a non-academic as at an academic audience. Much of the work goes on through high schools, through summer institutes for teachers and high school teachers. I've been privileged myself to participate in one of these. They also fund several awards, including the Lincoln and the Frederick Douglass Book Prizes for the best books in American history. And they offer a number of fellowships for scholars to work at the Institute and also in other libraries and collections. The Institute also helped set up the Gilda Lehmann Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University, which is presently directed by Professor David Blight, who will be the second lecturer in this series on the 24th of January. Now, in order to introduce Mr. Gilder, we have a very old friend of his who is here, and I must say also a friend of the Cold War Center and of my department here, Mr. Maurice Pinto, who's been instrumental in getting these links going. And I'd like to ask you, Maurice, to say a few words before turning over to Mr. Gilder. The right thing to do since you've known him for about 50 years.
I'll take 60 seconds to tell you something about Richard Gilder.
Use the mic.
Oh, sorry. I'm taking 20 minutes, I guess. I'll take 60 seconds to tell you about Richard Gilder, who Arne has just described. His lifelong career has been 50 years running a not huge but extremely successful money management business in New York. He has really dealt with looking after individuals, many of whom are his classmates from Yale University and a number of others, and has been extremely successful, he and his partners, been extremely successful in that business. In addition to that, Dick has devoted.
Could I call you Dick?
Dick has devoted a huge amount of his time, increasingly in recent years, to philanthropic activities. The two, three of which I'm quite aware, is he has been a tremendous supporter of Yale University, which he cares about a lot. In all sorts of ways. He is responsible for an initiative that made Central Park in New York City which was a garbage 15, 20 years ago. It looked like a garbage dump compared with Hyde Park. A visitor, a friend of mine visiting from New York the other day, said, you know, Central Park looks better than this as we walk through Hyde Park. And that's really saying something. And, of course, his commitment to American history is obvious by what's going on here. So that's my introduction.
Maury, thank you, and Arn, thank you, too. You know, American history, America, the United States, is the only country founded on ideas. All the others, like Great Britain, have physical, tribal commonality, but everyone who becomes an American, even an immigrant, shares in the ideas that are the basis of our heritage. And Gordon Wood couldn't be a more apt beginning of this series to discuss the Constitution and its origins, because many of our ideas, many of the good ones, came right from here. And we're enormously proud of that, and also beholden, if you will. This is the age of the internet. I don't have to tell you, young people, that even some of the folks my age are beginning to sidle up to it. It's also a global time, and yet so much of our life, so much of our studies are sequestered and isolated into specialties. In America, people occasionally have the courage to study British history. And some of you have the salt and let that brine go through you and study even American history. But isn't it all the same, really? Isn't this great history of, as Mr. Churchill would say, the English-speaking countries, and especially across the North Atlantic? And I'm hopeful that this series, thus being tonight inaugurated, will be the beginning of a rapprochement to continue the work of Winston Churchill. And in that process, we're leading with our ace, Gordon Wood. Maury Pinto was Yale class of 1955. Gordon Wood was Tufts University class of 55, went on to get his graduate degrees, his PhD at Harvard. And he is now a university professor at Brown. Now, to translate that academically, there's a little saying which all of us know in the States, but maybe not all of you have heard about Boston. And they say, Boston, I'm not quoting it perfectly, the land of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. And when God wishes to speak, especially on campus, he speaks to the university professors. This is by far the most exalted. And when a guy reaches that level, he doesn't have to go to committee meetings. I mean, what more can I say? No faculty. And something also unusual. A lot of American historians are great because of their research. They find a nugget, an opportunity, a new interpretation of some aspect of American history. And like a geologist, they mine that particular field. And whether or not they can write doesn't seem to matter. Now, those of us who are history majors learned that the hard way. But Gordon, following in the great tradition of Gibbon and Trevelyan and Churchill, is a wonderful writer. And so not only does he speak well, he writes well, you're in for a great treat. It's my great pleasure to introduce Gordon Wood, Brown University.
Gibbon, Churchill, those are tough acts to follow. thanks, Dick. I'm honored to be at LSE introducing this lecture series sponsored by the Gilda Lehrman Institute. It's a great honor. I'm happy to be here. I'm going to talk about American constitutionalism, the origins of it, which is really old hat these days. In fact, it's so old hat in the academy that there's nobody teaching it, except in the law schools. But undergraduates are not getting much constitutional history these days. There are other issues that are more pressing. This has led the Congress, in its wisdom, this year, to mandate that every September 17th, which was the day the U.S. Constitution was signed in 1787, to mandate that every university and college in the country which receives federal funds, which means almost all of them, must do something on that day to celebrate the Constitution. That's probably not the best way to get the academy interested in constitutionalism, but it seems to have come to that. It is old hat, I think, since the Constitution, the United States Constitution, is the oldest written national constitution in the world, there doesn't seem to be much that is new or peculiar about it. Certainly the fact that the Constitution is written is not unusual. Most constitutions these days are written, most of them written in the past three decades. When people talk about a country like Afghanistan or Iraq getting a constitution, they assume naturally that it'll be a written document. It now seems that writing one out on paper is the only way to create a constitution. Although I should point out that most newly written constitutions are a good deal longer than the 8,000 words of the American Constitution. In fact, actually, the American Constitution today has become as unwritten as your British Constitution. It used to be that America's separation of powers was unusual, if not unique, among governments, but not anymore. Lots of governments nowadays have independent judiciaries and presidents who are not members of their legislatures. But of course, the British parliamentary system of cabinet responsibility to the legislature still dominates the world, and thus the American system of separation of powers remains unusual. There was a time when judicial review was peculiarly American, but no longer. Many states in the world now have judiciaries that review legislation and have the authority to declare statutes null and void. Even the English courts, which you know better than I, which have always been respectful of parliamentary sovereignty, have recently begun trying to use the European Convention on Human Rights as a basis for interpreting or limiting parliamentary statutes. American courts no longer have a monopoly of judicial review. Foreign courts now routinely deal with the same issues that American courts deal with: right to life, freedom of speech, and issues of equality. In fact, foreign courts sometimes critically scrutinize and use American court decisions in reaching their own decisions. And some European judiciaries now declare more statutes void than does the American Supreme Court. Americans used to be known for their obsession with rights, but that obsession now seems to be shared more and more by other countries in the world, in the developed world at least. Most of the new constitutions of the past three decades have a core of basic rights and liberties which judges can refer to in their court decisions. Even the idea of separation of church and state, which Americans pioneered, has spread to other nations struggling with religious diversity. Federalism may have been a modern American invention, but has been much copied. Indeed, federalism is so common throughout the world today, Canada, Germany, Australia, that America's example is scarcely illuminating anymore. America may, in fact, be the most centralized of the many federal states, and thus the least interesting model. Despite all these modern similarities between the American Constitution and other national constitutions, however, it still may be worthwhile to look at the origins of America's constitutional tradition, and this is the subject of this talk. Now, the first thing to emphasize is the fact that the founders, or the framers as we call them, who created America's constitutional structure at the end of the 18th century were Englishmen. Now, in America today, there's a lot of criticism of the Iraqis or the Afghans. Why haven't they got their constitution together? We did it so quickly. But people forget that those framers at the end of the 18th century had over a century of experience with self-government and with dealing with electoral politics. So it's easy to forget just how experienced these Americans were. And they were experienced because they were Englishmen. Even when they were not Englishmen, they thought like Englishmen. John Jay, who became the first Supreme Court justice, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and was a very important founder. He was 3/8 French, French Huguenot, and 5/8 Dutch, with no English ancestry whatsoever. Nevertheless, Jay could declare with a straight face in Federalist No. 2, the Federalist Papers were those 85 papers written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay in defense of the Constitution in 1787-88. Jay wrote No. 2. He only wrote 5. He got ill. He wrote No. 2 with a straight face, no English heritage, that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who by their joint councils, arms, and efforts have nobly established general liberty and independence. Unlike many of the European countries, and this echo is this echoing what Dick Gilda just told you, unlike many of the European countries, which existed as nations before they were states, America was a state before it was a nation. And today, it may not be a nation in any traditional meaning of the term. If nations are imagined communities, then the new United States in the late 18th century was imagined as something resembling England, even by those like Jay, who had no English heritage whatsoever. 18th century Americans thought that England had become corrupted, but they believed that at one time in the past, England had been the dominant source of liberty and popular government in the world, its constitution celebrated by liberal intellectuals everywhere. Thus, it was fitting that the Anglo-Americans, which is the term, or the title most Europeans gave to the Americans in the early 19th century, these Anglo-Americans should become the heirs of this popular tradition of English rights and English liberty. Americans thought that the torch of English freedom had been passed to them, that they had a responsibility to make it shine brighter and more enduringly than the English had been able to do. The Americans were intent on avoiding the corruption that they believed plagued the English Constitution, and that meant that they had to deviate from the English constitutional tradition in a number of important ways. In fact, comparing the Americans' constitutional developments at the end of the 18th century with the English constitutional system that they broke away from can, I think, help to illuminate just what is distinctive about America's constitutionalism. Now, the most obvious difference, I've already touched upon that, between the 18th century English constitution and American constitutionalism was the revolutionaries' conception of the Constitution as a written document, as a fundamental law circumscribing the government. Before the American Revolution, a constitution in the English-speaking world was rarely ever distinguished from the government and its operations. Traditionally, in English culture, a constitution referred both to the way the government was put together or constituted and to the fundamental rights that the government was supposed to protect. The 18th century English constitution was an unwritten mixture of laws, customs, principles, and institutions. By the end of the Revolutionary era, however, the American Revolutionary era, by the early 1790s, the Americans' idea of a constitution had become very different. A constitution was now seen to be no part of the government at all. It was a written document distinct from and superior to all the operations of government. A constitution was, as Thomas Paine said in 1791 in his Rights of Man, which, by the way, is the best summary of American constitutional thinking, political thinking, after the Revolution. Paine said, a constitution is a thing antecedent to a government, and a government is only the creature of a constitution. And, said Paine, it was not a thing in name only, but in fact. It was a written document possessed by every family, said Paine, and carried about like the Bible, to be quoted and cited article by article. Such a constitution could never be an act of the legislature. It had to be an act of the people themselves. James Wilson put it in this way in 1790, and Wilson was one of the principal framers of the Constitution of 1787. It said it belonged to the people, and in their hands it is clay in the hands of a potter. They have the right to mold, to preserve, to improve, to refine, and to furnish it as they please. If 18th century Englishmen thought that this American idea of a constitution was, as the British writer Arthur Young caustically suggested in 1792, that it was simply a pudding made from some recipe, the Americans had become convinced by then that the English had no constitution at all. Now, as much as Americans today take for granted this idea of a constitution as written fundamental law, the idea was not easily arrived at, and this is important. The colonists began the debate with Great Britain in the 1760s, thinking about constitutional issues in much the same way as their fellow Englishmen. They didn't immediately jump to this notion of the Constitution as a fundamental document. They stumbled and fumbled with it, and it took years to work out their ideas. Like the English at home, Americans believed that the principal threat to the people's ancient rights and liberties had always been the prerogative powers of the king. The prerogative powers being those vague and discretionary but equally ancient rights of authority that the king possessed in order to carry out his responsibility for governing the realm, including the declaring of war, which was always a monarchical monopoly. Parliament had no say over the declaration of war, which is interesting in light of one of the things the constitution makers in America wanted to do was to take that power out of the executive, so to speak, out of the king, out of the presidency, and give it to Congress. But as you know, in the last 50 years, Americans have fought four wars, and none of them has been declared by Congress. An interesting constitutional development. 18th century Englishmen thought of their history essentially as a struggle between these ancient rights, the rights of the king, prerogative rights, and the rights of the people to their liberties, between power and liberty, so to speak, between an encroaching monarchy on one hand and a freedom-loving people on the other. Time and again in the colonial past, Americans, like their fellow Englishmen at home, had been forced to defend themselves against the intrusions of royal prerogative power. They relied for their defense on their colonial assemblies, much as the English relied on the House of Commons, to protect their rights as Englishmen and what they called, the colonists called, their ancient charters. Many of the colonies had written charters, which they turned into miniature constitutions, so to speak. In appealing to written documents as confirmations of their liberties, the colonists acted no differently from other Englishmen. From almost the beginning of their history, Englishmen had continually invoked written documents and charters in defense of their rights against the crown's power. All of these documents, from Magna Carta in 1215 to the Bill of Rights of the Glorious Revolution of 1689, were merely written evidence of those fixed principles of reason from which Englishmen believed their constitution was derived. Although 18th century Englishmen talked about the fixed principles and fundamental law of the English constitution, few of them doubted that Parliament, as the representative of the nobles and people, the lords and the House of and the Commons, and as the sovereign lawmaking body of the nation, was the supreme guarantor and interpreter of those fixed principles of fundamental law. Parliament was, in fact, the bulwark of the people's liberties against the crown's encroachments. It alone, and this is, I don't have to tell you, although I have a hard time convincing my American students of this, Parliament alone defended and confirmed the people's rights. The Petition of Right, the Act of Habeas Corpus, the Bill of Rights of 1689, these were all acts of Parliament, statutes, not different in form from the other statutes passed by Parliament. For Englishmen, therefore, as William Blackstone, the great 18th century jurist, pointed out, there could be no distinction between what he called the Constitution or frame of government and the system of laws. All were of a piece. Every act of Parliament was part of the Constitution, and all law, both customary and statute, was thus constitutional. Therefore, concluded the 18th century English theorist William Paley, the terms constitutional and unconstitutional mean legal and illegal. Now, nothing could be more strikingly different from what Americans came to believe in a very short period of time. Indeed, it was precisely on this distinction between legal and constitutional that the American and English constitutional traditions diverged at the time of the Revolution. During the 1760s and 70s, the colonists came to realize that although acts of Parliament, like the Stamp Act of 1765, might be legal, that is, in accord with the acceptable way of making law, such acts could not thereby be automatically considered constitutional, that is, in accord with the basic principles of right and justice that made the English Constitution what it was. It was true that the English Bill of Rights and the Act of Settlement of 1701 were only statutes of Parliament, but truly, the colonists insisted, they were of a nature more sacred than those which established a turnpike road. Now, under this kind of pressure, the Americans came to believe that the fundamental principles of the English Constitution had to be lifted out of the lawmaking institutions of government and set above them. Thus, in 1776, when Americans came to make their own state constitutions for their newly independent states, they inevitably sought to make them fundamental and to write them out in documents. These state constitutions of 1776-77, which were immediately translated into several European languages, captured the imagination of the enlightened everywhere. Even Americans forget how important that state constitution experiment was. The federal constitution came a decade later and was very much dependent on the initial experience of 1776 in writing the state constitutions. In fact, the original Articles of Confederation was 13 states coming together in a treaty. The Articles of Confederation are very similar to the present-day European Union. The decade later, the federal constitution, which is still in existence, created a modern government that operated directly on individuals. You can understand the first national constitution if you think of it as similar to your present-day European Union. But it was one thing, however, to define the Constitution as fundamental law, different from ordinary legislation and circumscribing the institutions of government. It was quite another to make such a distinction effective. Since the constitutions were created by the legislature, they presumably could also be changed or amended by the legislatures. Some of the constitution makers in 1776 saw the problem and tried to deal with it. Delaware, the state of Delaware, provided for a supermajority, 5/7 of the legislature, for changing the Constitution. Maryland said that its Constitution could only be amended by a 2/3 vote of two successive legislatures. You can see they're fumbling with it. How do we make it different from a statute? How do we make it fundamental? They don't know. And they're experimenting with these various techniques. Most states, however, simply enacted their constitutions as if they were regular statutes. Everyone believed that the constitutions were special kinds of law, but no one knew quite how to make them special kinds of law. In the years following the Declaration of Independence, Americans struggled with this problem of distinguishing fundamental from statutory law, none more persistently than Thomas Jefferson. In 1779, Jefferson knew from experience that no legislature elected by the people for the ordinary purposes of legislation only could restrain the acts of succeeding legislatures. Thus he realized that to declare his great act for religious freedom, one of the great documents in world history, I think, separating church and state, in Virginia, his great act for establishing religious freedom in Virginia, to declare it to be irrevocable would be of no effect in law, he said. Yet we are free, he wrote into his 1779 bill in frustration, to declare and do declare that if any act shall hereafter be passed to repeal the present act or to narrow its operation, such an act will be an infringement of natural right. In other words, he's saying a curse upon you if you do anything to this act. That's all he could do. He had no other way of making it really fundamental since it was just a statute. But he realized immediately, of course, that such a paper declaration was not enough and something more was needed. By the 1780s, both he and his friend James Madison, who became the so-called father of the federal constitution, Both of them were eager to form a real constitution, as they said, for Virginia. The existing one, they said, was merely an ordinance with no higher authority than the other ordinances of the same session. They wanted a constitution that would be perpetual and unalterable by other legislatures. And the only way that could be done was to have the constitution created, as Jefferson put it, by a power superior to that of the legislature. By the time Jefferson came to write his notes on the state of Virginia in the early 1780s, the answer had become clear. To render a form of government unalterable by ordinary acts of assembly, wrote Jefferson, the people must delegate persons with special powers, and they have accordingly chosen special conventions to form and fix their governments. Massachusetts in 1780 had shown the way. The Massachusetts Constitution of 1780 is actually the oldest written constitution. It's not a national constitution, but the oldest written constitution in the world. It's still in existence. It's coming up to the 225th anniversary this year. It elected a convention in 1780, specially designated to form a constitution. After struggling for 4 years to find a way to do this, they had written an early constitution, 1778, which was flawed in some way, and the people had turned it down. And they had placed that constitution before the people for ratification. When the Philadelphia Convention drew up a new constitution for the nation in 1787, they knew what to do because of this experience in Massachusetts. And that convention declared that the new constitution had to be ratified by the people, meeting in state conventions called for that purpose only, not the legislatures, but special conventions. Constitutional conventions, which are now the major means by which the states have amended their constitutions over the years, and the process of ratification, popular ratification, made the people themselves the actual constituent power. As enlightened Europeans realized, these devices were some of the most distinctive contributions the American Revolution made to world politics. But these were not the only contributions. With a conception of a constitution as fundamental law, immune from legislative encroachment, more firmly in hand, some state judges during the 1780s began cautiously moving in isolated cases to impose restraints on what the assemblies were enacting as law. In effect, they said the legislatures, as George Wythe, who was a judge of the Virginia Supreme Court, said in 1782, here is the limit of your authority, and hither shall you go, but no further. These were the hesitant, and I say hesitant, emphasize that, beginnings of what would come to be called judicial review, a term that was actually coined in 1910 by Edward Corwin. It's that remarkable practice by which judges in the ordinary courts of law have the authority to determine the constitutionality of acts of the state and federal legislatures. Now, this development of judicial review came slowly. It was not, and it's still not easy for lots of people to understand. It was certainly not easy for people in the 18th century, even those who were convinced that many of the acts of the state legislatures in the 1780s were unjust and unconstitutional. It was difficult to believe that unelected judges could set aside acts of the popularly elected legislatures. This seemed to be an undemocratic usurpation of power, and it still does to many people in the United States. But as early as 1787, James Iredell, soon to be appointed as an associate justice of the newly created Supreme Court of the United States, saw that the new meaning Americans had given to the Constitution had clarified the responsibility of judges to determine the law. A constitution in America, said Iredell, was not only a fundamental law, but also a special popularly created law in writing, limiting the powers of the legislature, and with which every exercise of those powers must necessarily be compared. Judges were not arbiters of the Constitution or usurpers of legislative power. They were, said Iredell, merely judicial officials fulfilling their duty of applying the proper law. When faced with a decision between the fundamental, unrepealable law made especially by the people and an ordinary statute enacted by the legislature contrary to the Constitution, they must simply declare which law was superior. Judges could not avoid exercising this authority, concluded Iredell, for in America, a constitution was not a mere imaginary thing about which 10,000 different opinions may be formed, but a written document to which all may have recourse and to which, therefore, the judges cannot witfully blind themselves. Although Iredell may have been wrong about the number of different opinions that could arise over a written constitution, he was certainly right about the direction judicial authority in America would take. The way was prepared for Supreme Court Justice John Marshall's decision in Marbury versus Madison in 1803 and the subsequent but bitterly contested development of the practice of judicial review, a practice that Europeans soon became aware of. Unlike the European and Israeli constitutional courts, the American courts are not special courts with special constitutional responsibilities, separate from ordinary law adjudication. This is an important point of distinction whose implications, I think, are not easy to spell out. Because the European and the Israeli constitutional courts are so special, they are usually protected from partisanship by elaborate mechanisms of appointment. The Israeli system of appointment, for example, is indirect and largely removed from the politics of the Knesset. As we know only too well from experiences today with the appointment of Supreme Court justices and judges in general, federal judges in general, Americans have no such indirect method of appointing our judges. Thus, Senate filibustering of appointments may be becoming a crude means of requiring a supermajority for federal court appointments. Of course, this is simply a measure of how significant judges have become in America's constitutional system. Now, as important as the idea of a written constitution, distinguishable from ordinary statute law, was in the 18th century, it was not, however, the most significant constitutional deviation the 18th century Americans made from their inherited English traditions. More important in distinguishing American constitutionalism from that of the English and most other democratic nations in the world today was the idea of separation of powers. Now, Montesquieu, in his Spirit of Laws, had praised the English Constitution for separating the executive, legislature, and legislative and judicial powers of government. But Montesquieu did not understand precisely what was happening in the English Constitution in the 18th century. The legislature, that is Parliament, and the executive, that is the king's ministry, were in fact becoming blurred as England stumbled into what eventually became its modern parliamentary system of responsible cabinet government. The key, as you know only too well, the key to the British system is the fact that the ministers of the crown are simultaneously members of Parliament. It was this linkage, which the Americans colonists labeled corruption, in 1776, the Americans were determined to destroy that linkage between executive ministers and legislative seats. Thus, in their state constitutions in 1776, they excluded from their assemblies all members of the executive branch, so that, as the New Jersey Constitution declared, the legislative department of this government may, as much as possible, be preserved from all suspicion of corruption. They assumed that the crown was buying off members of the House of Commons by appointing them to royal offices, and they wanted to avoid that. This separation that was articulated in all of the state constitution in 1776 was repeated in the federal constitution, Article 1, Section 6, preventing the development of responsible cabinet government in America. So that when William Cowan, who was a Republican senator from Maine, was appointed Secretary of Defense by the Clinton administration, he immediately had to resign his seat as a senator in order to take on a ministerial position. That's the exact opposite, of course, of what happens in England. You have to have a seat in the House of Commons or the House of Lords to be a minister. If you lose your seat, you're going to have to resign your ministry until you can find a seat that gets you back into the legislature. In this respect, of course, American constitutionalism has not been influential at all. For most democratic governments in the world have tended to follow your system, a parliamentary responsible government, not the American system. But beneath these obvious differences between the constitutionalism of Great Britain and America are even more fundamental deviations that help to make America's conception of government and politics different from nearly every other nation in the world today. These differences began with the concept of representation. During the debates over the nature of the empire in the 1760s and the 1770s, the British vainly tried to justify Parliament's taxation of the colonies. They argued that the American colonists, like Englishmen everywhere, were subject to acts of Parliament through a system of what they called virtual representation. Now, we're familiar with virtual. It's become part of our computer world. That's the term they used, interestingly enough. Even though the colonists, as the ministerial defenders said, like 9/10 of the people of Britain, did not in fact choose any representatives to the House of Commons, they were undoubtedly a part and an important part of the Commons of Great Britain. They are represented in Parliament in the same manner as those inhabitants of Britain who are represented, who have no voices in elections. In other words, it didn't matter that you voted. Representation was not tied to voting. Now, to most mainstream Englishmen at home, this argument of virtual representation made a great deal of sense. Centuries of history had left Britain with a confusing mixture of sizes and shapes of its electoral districts. Some of the constituencies were large, with thousands of voters, but others were small and more or less in the pocket of a single great landowner. Many of the electoral districts had few voters, and some so-called rotten boroughs had no inhabitants at all, as famous as Old Sarum, of course. But Dunwich, the town of Dunwich, had long since slipped into the North Sea, but it continued to send two members of Parliament to London. At the same time, some of England's largest cities, which had grown up mushroom style in the 18th century, like Manchester and Birmingham, with 50,000 inhabitants, sent no representatives to Parliament. So you had this, by American standards, very odd system. The British justified this hodgepodge of representation by claiming that each member of Parliament represented the whole British nation, the Commons as a whole, not just the particular locality that he supposedly came from. Requirements that the MPs reside in the constituencies they represented had long since been ignored, had fallen away, and of course are still not necessary. It's not necessary for a member of Parliament to be a resident of the constituency he stands for or she stands for. According to this idea of virtual representation, people were represented in England not by the process of election, which was incidental to representation, but rather by the mutual interests that the members of Parliament were presumed to share with all Englishmen for whom they spoke, including those like the colonists who did not actually vote for them. Now, the Americans, 3,000 miles away, strongly rejected these British claims that they were virtually represented in the same way that the non-voters of cities like Manchester and Birmingham were. They challenged the idea of virtual representation with what they called actual representation. If the people were to be properly represented in a legislature, the colonists declared, not only did the people have to vote directly for the members of the legislature, but they also had to be represented by members whose numbers were proportionate to the size of the population they spoke for. What purpose is served, asked James Otis of Massachusetts in 1765, by the continual attempts of Englishmen to defend the lack of American representation in Parliament by citing the examples of Manchester and Birmingham, which returned no members to the House of Commons. If those now so considerable places are not represented, said Otis, they ought to be. What was meaningful in England made no sense in America. Unlike England, electoral districts in the New World were not the products of history that stretched back centuries, but rather were recent and regular creations that were related to changes in population. When new towns in Massachusetts were or new counties in Virginia were created, new representatives customarily were sent to the respective colonial legislatures. This system of actual representation stressed the closest possible connection between the local electors and their representatives. Unlike the English, Americans believed that the representatives had to be residents of the localities they spoke for, and that people of the locality had the right to instruct their representatives. Americans thought it only fair that the localities be represented more or less in proportion to their population. In short, the American belief in actual representation pointed toward the fullest and most equal participation of the people in the process of government that the modern world had ever seen. Since this actual representation was based on the people's mistrust of those they elected, they pushed for the most explicit and broadest kinds of consent, which generally meant voting. The mutuality of interest that made virtual representation meaningful in England was in America so weak, so tenuous, that the representatives could not be trusted to speak for the interests of their constituents unless they actually voted for them. Actual representation thus made the process of election not incidental to representation, but central to it. Election became the criterion of representation for Americans. Actual representation became the key to the peculiarities of American constitutionalism and government. People wanted elected officials that were like them in every way, not only in ideas, but in religion, ethnicity, or social class. You have the first examples of this in Philadelphia in 1775. When these revolutionary committees were formed, groups of Presbyterians said, we got to have too many Anglicans, too many Quakers, we want some Presbyterians on that committee. Or the artisans said, well, you've got too many gentlemen, we want so many artisans on the committee. Or they said, we need to have some Germans. A third of the population of Pennsylvania was German. And the whole thing was dominated by Anglos, and they wanted German representation, proportionate to their numbers in the population. That kind of ethnic or religious or class representation became very much a part of American thinking right from the outset. So the elected representatives not only had to be for the people, they actually had to be of the people. Mistrust became the source of American democracy. Indeed, the mistrust at times became so great that the representative process was brought into question, and mobs and extra legal associations emerged to claim to speak more authentically and authoritatively for the people than their elected representatives. The people, it seemed, could be represented in a variety of ways and in a variety of institutions. But no official, however many votes they received, could ever fully embody the people. Now, ultimately, these contrasting ideas of representation separated the English and American constitutional systems. In England, Parliament came to possess sovereignty, the final, supreme, and indivisible lawmaking authority in the state, because it embodied the whole society. All the estates of the realm, the social orders of the realm, were in Parliament. The Commons, the people were in the Commons, the Lords were in the House of, the Peers were in the House of Lords, and the King as the third estate, the first estate actually, was embodied in the monarchy. And nothing existed outside of it. That's important. Parliament, in a sense, eclipsed the people, the society. It was the society acting. In America, however, sovereignty remained with the people themselves, and not with any of their agents, or even with all their agents put together. The American people, unlike the English, were never eclipsed by the process of representation. And I think that's still true to a large extent, even in England itself, although there's a gap opening up. When you have a referendum, and you had one in the 70s on joining the common market, you opened up a gap between the House of Commons and the people that has implications for the future. And you've got promises now that there will be more referenda, one on the euro and one on the EU constitution. And if you begin opening up this gap between the people and the House of Commons, God knows where it'll end. You could end up like Americans. But it is a serious issue. Up to that time, as far as I know, in fact, the gallery in the House of Commons is still called the Strangers Gallery, the public gallery, where the people come to watch their representatives debate, is called the Strangers Gallery. The people don't really exist politically or legally, the English people, except at the moment of election, and then they go out of business until the next election. Americans don't think that. When they referred to the sovereignty of the people, they did not just mean all government was derived from the people. Instead, that was old hat. No, everybody believed that. Instead, they meant that the final, supreme, and indivisible lawmaking authority of the society remained with the people themselves, not with their representatives or with any of their agents. In American thinking, all public officials became delegated, mistrusted agents of the people, temporarily holding bits and pieces of the people's power out, so to speak, on always recallable loan. By thinking of the people in this extraordinary way, Americans were able to conceive of federalism, that is, the remarkable division of power between central and provincial governments. By creating two legislatures with different powers operating over the same territory, the Congress and the separate state legislatures, the Americans offered the world a new way of organizing government. Only by conceiving of sovereignty remaining with the people could Americans make sense of their new constitutional achievements, such as the idea of a special constitutional convention, constitution-making convention, and the process of popular ratification of constitutions. In America, the notion that sovereignty rested with the people was not just a convenient political fiction. The American people, unlike the English, retained an actual lawmaking authority. The English did not need conventions or popular ratifications to change their constitution because Parliament, as I mentioned, was fully and completely the people. And the people did not exist politically or constitutionally outside of Parliament, except at the moment of election. Once election became for Americans the sole criterion of representation, then it was natural to think of all elected officials as somehow representatives of the people. And as early as the 1780s, many Americans were referring to their elected senates as double representations of the people. Some began claiming that their governors, because they were elected by all the people, were the most representative officials of the, in the state. Soon, all elected officials were being designated representatives of the people. And the term originally applied to the various houses of representatives in the state constitutions and in the federal constitution became awkward reminders that Americans had once thought of representation as the English had, as confined to the lower houses of their legislatures. And we're left with this legacy. We have houses of representatives, we have senates, but all are representatives of the people. And the term House of Representatives is just an awkward reminder that we once thought of it much as you do. With their notion of sovereignty remaining with the people inevitably concluded that all governmental officials were somehow their various agents, including even judges. When in order to justify judicial review in the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton in number 78 referred to the judges as agents of the people, not really inferior, he said, to the people's other agents in the legislature, he opened up a radically new way of thinking of the judiciary. If judges were indeed the people's agents, as many soon concluded, then rightfully they ought to be elected, especially since election had become the sole measure of representation. And sure enough, states in the early 19th century began electing their judges. Until today, there are at least 37 states that elect their judges. Now, the federal judiciary is not elected. It would require a constitutional amendment, which is very difficult to achieve. But there, everywhere else, states have various forms of electing judges, which probably from the English point of view is extraordinary. Chief Justice Roberts, who's just confirmed as Chief Justice, in his testimony, he said, well, I'm not running for office. I'm not elected. But he forgot about all those poor judges out there in Minnesota and Kentucky and elsewhere that have to run for election every 7 years or 8 years or whatever. Extraordinary kind of development, especially since the Supreme Court, in its wisdom, has decided that they can campaign and spend money like a politician running for office. It's only the logic of this thinking that's carried out to its fullest that created that system. Since in that system, the people were never fully embodied in the government, all sorts of strange and bizarre political institutions and practices could and did emerge. The primaries, referendums, processes of recall, and ballot initiatives introduced by progressive reformers at the beginning of the 20th century were only extensions of the idea of popular sovereignty and acute actual representation created by the founding of the United States. As you perhaps knew about several years ago, 2003, the people of California recalled their governor. Governor Gray Davis was recalled after only 18 months in office, and a new election was held, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was elected governor of the state of California. This is the kind of popular action not likely to be duplicated in any other developed democracy in the world. But once we grasp the peculiar American idea of the sovereignty of the people, these extraordinary political events begin to make some sense. Whether this direct democracy, our sensible way, these forms of direct democracy are sensible ways of running a modern democracy, however, remains to be seen. But you'll have to admit, they're thoroughly American. Thank you. I'll be happy to take questions, comments.
We will have questions. Let me just thank you very much again, Gordon, for this lecture. It's the most precise, well-formulated lecture I've heard in this hall for a long time, and we had some pretty good speakers here recently. It was a masterful performance by a master historian. We have about 10 minutes for questions. Not going to take very many of them, but I want to open up for a few questions from the audience. I don't know if you want to. You could stand over there, or you could sit down.
No, I'd be happy to. Yes, sir. Here.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yep, right here. Oh, I see the mic.
Well, I was thinking about you talking about representation, and I was wondering about the Three-Fifths Compromise in terms of allowing black slaves to be represented and determining the number of representatives in the House, but not allowing them to vote. Were there any conversations over that contradiction?
Oh, it was a big issue, and it's become an issue today among historians. I've got a review coming out in the New York Review of Books, which deals a little bit with this issue. Let me just say that in no way did the three-fifths representation, a counting of slaves as three-fifths, suggest that slaves were only three-fifths of a human being. That was not, it was a compromise. The alternative, you see, to the three-fifths was five-fifths representation, which is what Madison argued for in the Constitutional Convention, which would have meant more representation for the southern slaveholders. So the Northerners, who were opposed to Southern power and Southern strength, wanted no fifths. They didn't want the slaves counted at all. Now, the fact that the slaves did not vote, of course, was not really relevant because neither did women and children vote, but they were nonetheless counted for the purposes of representation. So it was an issue over power, and the compromise was one between the Northern states and the Southern states, the alternatives being no fifths or five-fifths, the South wanting five-fifths, full counting of the slaves for representational purposes. So that is the context for understanding it. It in no way, it has been misread and used in other ways. In no way did it mean to suggest that people regarded black slaves as three-fifths of a person. The South wanted them fully represented because it would be in their interests to do so. So that was the basis for the compromise. Yes, sir.
Was the Electoral College a weak moment for active representation?
No, it was not a weak moment. It was it turned out to be something of an awkward thing. But at the time, it made perfect sense. They could not anticipate, the founders could not anticipate political parties, nor did they anticipate mass media. So after they got past George Washington, how would you elect the president? You can't just, with no parties, no organizing of tickets, it would be chaos. And so they thought that a group of elites, so to speak, electors, who would be different from the congressmen, who would be elected in each of their communities for their own standing, would be independent and would vote for the president. That's the way they thought it would work. Now, once the parties developed and the parties began selecting people, then everything was changed. And by the 12th Amendment, which came in 1804, the modern system was essentially working. But it was just simply not anticipated. They just simply did not anticipate political parties. So they thought it would be chaos. How would you know? How would anyone in Massachusetts know whom to vote for in Georgia, or who were the likely candidates? There would be no campaigning. There would be none of the modern media. So the whole thing, it's just an example of an institution was created for other purposes, lingering on. Very unlikely that it will be changed, because the small states tend to benefit from it. They get a little more clout, because the Electoral College is really an alternative Congress. See, they first thought, how are we going to elect the president? They first said, well, let the Congress elect him. Well, then he'll be dependent on the Congress. Well, we'll make him serve one term, 7 years long. Oh, no, that's too long. They went back and forth over this, and they finally said, let's create an alternative other Congress. And that's what the Electoral College is. It's another Congress. That's how it was supposed to be, with people having only one function, to elect the president. Now the electors have no independence, presumably. Occasionally an elector votes against what he's supposed to do, but by and large they are simply figureheads, and they go with the majority vote of the state. Yes, sir. Thank you.
So you said that America was different insofar as it believes in popular rather than parliamentary sovereignty. Might you not be able to argue that on the biggest issues of the day, the people really just get ignored? Because when it comes to issues of peace or war, amending the Constitution, judicial review, impeaching the president, all of these things, in fact, happen without the people having any say on them. So don't you think you might have been over-egging the pudding when it comes to popular sovereignty? There's no national referendum. No. If you want to get rid of real iniquities in legislation, slavery, lack of civil rights and things, the people aren't asked about that. Or peace and war, as you said.
No, that's true, although I think popular opinion is very powerful in America. I've always thought about it in terms of freedom of speech. You have all kinds of laws limiting racial statements and so on. They wouldn't be allowed in America because of the First Amendment. But I've lived in England enough to know that in private, you are far more free in your opinions than Americans are. They're intimidated by the culture. So actually, America is really, as Tocqueville pointed out, is really American life is determined a great deal by public opinion. Now, it's true they have to wait. We have to wait till the end of the election, 4 years. Unlike England, where you can have an election overnight, you can have a decision. We have elections every 4 years. I might point out that in our Civil War, we held an election in the middle of the war. You didn't do that in 1940. They just suspended the electoral process, and Parliament did, until the war was over. So we do, I think, the elected officials and the judiciary really do follow the voters' sentiments. That's how judicial review operates, pretty much. There are things that the court will not declare unconstitutional because, I mean, think about, we talk about separation of church and state, but so far, Christmas is still a federal holiday. No one has dared take that on yet. Now, it may happen. I do think that Americans are really very, the American politicians are very susceptible to public opinion and are scared to death. They elect, House gets elected every 2 years. These people are constantly running for office. I don't think that's the healthiest way to do things, but so I think they're very, very susceptible to public opinion. Yes, sir.
I think that will have to be the last one.
A lot of responsibility on you now.
Yes, I know. I'm a terrible English skeptic, so you'll have to forgive this. I never understood the American concept of a fundamental law. You've had so many amendments to your constitution that to talk about anything as fundamental seems to me to be a misuse of the term. The fundamentals of life do not involve propertied people having domination over the less well-off, which is how the original framers of the Constitution thought of life. Secondly, is it for James Madison to tell us what is fundamental? Thirdly, in the question of freedom of speech, that was an amendment to the Constitution, it was never in there. The Constitution never said we grant you freedom of speech. It said we assume there's freedom of speech around, so you may as well have it. So what I can't understand in all of these things is how you can describe such a scenario as fundamental. Would you please enlighten me?
Well, we got an English skeptic in the end.
I would say that I didn't deal with this, but as I said at the outset, the American Constitution is as unwritten as yours is. And yours is as written as ours is. You've got a lot of written documents that you appeal to. So I think we're all operating with conventions, with customs, and we muddle through. I do think that the fundamentality of some issues gets reflected in Supreme Court decisions. I think there's a sense that the political officials here, as well as in the states, have limits set on them by the culture, by the customs, and those are far more important than any written document. I mean, if a written document mattered, you could just send it out to the people of the world and say, hey, just copy this and you'll be in good shape. Of course it doesn't work that way. What really counts is the common sense of the people, the heritage you have, the conventions you've developed, That's what makes a state work. That's why it's a big deal if these states like Afghanistan and Iraq can create a constitution and have it work. The chances are that it probably won't work as well as people hope, because there's not much experience behind it. What really counts is that experience. And so I think there is a fundamental constitution operating in England, as in Britain, as well as in the United States. It's in the minds and hearts of the subjects and citizens of the two peoples.
Well, Jim, I think the idea that you came up with about a year ago to do these lectures, in terms of the first lecture in the series, has worked out in a way that is even better than any of us could have guessed when we asked the Institute to undertake this lecture series. Let me thank you again, Gordon, for a truly fundamental lecture that has helped us not just with our understanding of the origins of American constitutionalism, but I think to a large extent also helped us understand much about what is going on in terms of our constitutional debate in America today. So thank you again very, very much for coming.